The longer you study business, the more you will realize that a lot of big decisions are made by people with ideas that sound good in theory, but simply don't hold up to any kind of scrutiny. Be your own boss, money doesn't buy happiness, private enterprise is always more efficient because of the profit motive, or even the good old people are afraid of hard work these days. These simple little anecdotes sound reasonable enough, maybe even sensible, but according to the data, they are also all wrong. Now, that's a problem, because people really do live by these catchy little turns of phrase, and in one way or another, it will cost them a lot of money. Unfortunately, when it takes an hour of sifting through peer-reviewed studies to refute a line that takes 2 seconds to blurt out, we are probably fighting a losing battle. What's even worse is that a lot of people are in no hurry to correct some of the worst ideas in business because they are really, really profitable.
Be your own boss.
I think I love owning and running and operating the business even more.
I love having a lot of money. It's a whole lot better to be rich than it is to be broke. But I was happy when I was poor. I just was happier when I was rich.
If we're growing jobs, private sector jobs at a couple hundred thousand a month, that's good.
Business ethics has become a big business in its own right. It's grown from a fringe issue that some small-time alternative CEOs might mention in passing, to a corporate staple that has its own course in 90% of the business schools in America. Major companies now mix in ethical initiatives with their earnings reports, and there are even dedicated research centers focused on studying how companies can solve all of the world's problems with some combination of acronyms. DEI, CSR, ESG, TBL, whatever your favorite is, they are all guidelines for how the world's most powerful companies can look out for something other than their own free cash flow. So then, why the fuck is this the second worst idea in business history?
Every day that my dad came to work, he came home and he was happy and he was fulfilled.
If it is about serving as many people as possible, then the right place is born.
We are looking at how we are training and giving leadership development and making coaching available from the very best to every one of our distributors.
Corporate social responsibility or ethical business, whatever you want to call it, it should be an easy idea to sell. You probably don't like it when companies pollute your home, take your money with deceptive practices, or lobby your government to spend your tax money on their bailouts. But operating ethically in business often comes at the expense of acting profitably. And company leadership, who answers exclusively to their shareholders, will be forced into picking profits over ethics. Corporate social responsibility, therefore, is all about showing company managers, their boards, and their shareholders that there is a way that everybody can win, and that ethics and profit don't have to be at odds with one another. The message of the double bottom line is catching on. It now has some big name supporters like Klaus Schwab, the chairman of the World Economic Forum, who literally wrote a book on stakeholder capitalism. The World Economic Forum is a controversial organization best known for an annual meeting where the world's rich and powerful meet up in the Swiss Alps to talk about how the world ought to be run. Stakeholder capitalism has been one of their big initiatives, and in theory, it doesn't actually sound like a bad idea. It basically says that instead of companies looking after their shareholders, they should look after all of their stakeholders, which in addition to their investors, also includes their employees, their suppliers, customers, and society at large. The idea of getting companies to be on their best behavior is not just lip service either. There is now some serious money behind it. According to Bloomberg, investment funds that specifically invest in ethical companies now hold over $7 trillion in assets under management. But there are three reasons why corporate social responsibility, or whatever you want to call it, is the second worst business idea in history. It's bad for employees, it's bad for shareholders, and worst of all, it's bad for everybody else. The first reason is that it puts all of the power into all of the wrong hands. If you put a tiger in a petting zoo for a kid's third birthday party, it's not the tiger's fault that there is no fourth birthday. It's the fault of the adults that should have known to put the proper restrictions in place to make sure that the tiger couldn't feast on little Timmy. This does not dismiss or forgive the bad actions of companies. If you are subscribed to our other channel, you will know that history is littered with companies committing actual crimes against humanity in the name of maximizing profit. But it should not be their job to decide for themselves what is right or wrong. And least of all, should it be up to them to enforce ethical standards. That is the job of real lawmakers, real courts, and real authorities. Initiatives like ESG investing, industry standard corporate governance controls, and yes, stakeholder capitalism have been used to lobby against official government regulation that could actually hold bad actors accountable. Companies have said that instead of the real authorities with some teeth regulating them, they will regulate themselves, and they pinky promise that this will be a win-win for everybody. The tiger has promised that it's gone vegetarian. and there are no need for those electric fences that the zookeepers were thinking of installing anymore. Companies like Shell, BP, Exxon, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, Boeing, Monsanto, Nestle, and worst of all, EA, all have pages and publications dedicated to talking about their ethical standards, corporate diversity, and environmental controls. Researchers at Columbia University and the London School of Economics compared the ESG records of US companies and ESG funds to non-ESG companies. They found that the companies in the ESG portfolios actually had worse compliance records for both labor and environmental rules. Their ethical efforts were mostly performative to get regulators to look the other way. Even when these companies do get caught doing stuff that's not only unethical but downright illegal, the image of corporate ethics is still valuable. A report by The Economist found that firms that had been convicted of bribery in the US under the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act received more lenient fines if they had been seen to be actively engaging in comprehensive CSR practices. Instead of being a major shakeup to their operations, companies took the threat of regulation and turned it into a marketing campaign and an investment opportunity. According to a market report by PwC, ESG funds have been some of the fastest growing investment tools in history. Bloomberg Intelligence estimates that environmental, social, and governance-derived investments will be worth $40 trillion by 2030 and represent a quarter of all financial assets under management. That's not bad for an initiative designed to dissuade overzealous regulators. It's understandable that investors would like their money going towards companies that are, at the very least, trying to do the right thing. But unfortunately, not many people really understand how these investments work, or how they could actually be making these problems a lot worse. So it's time to learn how money works to find out why corporate ethics is the second worst idea in business history. As AI continues to reshape how knowledge is captured and shared, productivity tools are evolving to meet the needs of professionals across industries. Plaud, the sponsor of today's video, represents the shift, an AI tool that actually helps you do better work instead of just replacing work with generated slop. Plaud builds cutting-edge tools that help you stay focused on the moment by taking care of all your note-taking and summarizing. The Plaud Note is a credit card-sized device that you can attach to your phone or tuck into your wallet. It's designed for professionals who need to capture calls and in-person conversations with one tap, then get smart, structured notes right after. You can record up to 30 hours and easily preview or summarize key parts using 20-plus professional templates for interviews, meetings, and more, all customizable to fit your workflow. I've been using the Note in client calls and team check-ins. I just press record and later everything shows up in the app, organized, summarized, even searchable. It's like having an assistant who doesn't miss a beat. And it doesn't just stop at summary. With the Ask AI feature, you can let it do more smart tasks, ask AI questions and pieces of information you need, and get some tasks done by AI. You can even consult AI on work-related topics or even beyond. It even works for phone calls, which has been a game changer, especially when you're juggling multiple conversations a day. You can check it out and get yours using the link in the description. Swapping out real regulations with real consequences for self-governance would be okay if it worked. But ESG and other brands of corporate ethics have shown too often to be worse than literally doing nothing at all. If you invest into an ESG fund, what you are really doing is buying a slice of lots of companies that a fund maker like Vanguard, BlackRock, or a smaller investment manager has decided meets their ESG or corporate ethics criteria. The idea is that by directing your investment money towards these companies, they can grow faster and outcompete companies that are behaving unethically or damaging the environment. The problem is that a lot of the most popular funds don't really work like this at all. A report from the Harvard Business Review found that some of the most popular funds with a corporate ethics or environmental thesis actually had a larger weighting of fossil fuel companies than just a broad market index. BlackRock's U.S. Carbon Readiness Transition Exchange Traded Fund sounds like an investment into a pool of companies improving battery technology, building renewable power stations, or making electric vehicles. Right? Wrong. What this fund actually does is invest into companies that BlackRock believes will be the best positioned to benefit from the transition to a low-carbon economy. Oil companies are heavily weighted in the fund because they will benefit from more expensive energy prices and government subsidies during any transition. So this supposedly ethical investment opportunity is not so much encouraging a transition as much as it's trying to profit from it while letting the investment manager that put it together charge a higher fee than they would be able to charge for a regular passive index fund. Other funds are slightly less misleading towards their well-intentioned investors and will try to invest into companies doing good, but even that has major problems. There are three methods for building these ethical funds: the active, the inclusion, and the exclusion method. An active fund will have a team of analysts picking which companies they believe will do well based on an investment criteria, in this case, good ethical credentials. Actively managed funds charge higher fees because they have to cover the large salaries of market researchers who decide what stocks to buy and what stocks to sell at what time. After accounting for these fees, most actively managed funds underperform the market, so they are becoming less popular with investors. The inclusion method requires a little bit less effort from the fund manager. These funds work by filling an index with companies that are in ethical industries or doing things that people consider ethical behavior, like having a benchmark of diversity on their board or in senior management positions. You may not personally consider criteria like the diversity of board members worth investing in, but there are thousands of different funds, all with different ethical criteria. The exclusion method is the most passive of all. It will just take an existing fund and kick out particularly bad companies. The problem with all of these methods is that it can be very hard to build a diverse portfolio of ethical companies, so they lower their standards or pick the least bad option. Exxon and Shell are both oil and gas companies, but maybe Shell built a few more windmills or purchased more carbon credits, so they would be included in a fund that wanted to be ethical but wants exposure to energy more. Even that wouldn't be so bad if these investments still did well, but they don't. Some investors don't really care about how ethical the companies they invest in are. They just think that ESG investing will still outperform the market as a general trend towards more accountable business takes place. The market for these funds is still new, and maybe there is a long-term benefit of how these ethical companies operate, but unfortunately, ethically constructed funds have consistently underperformed the market. But this all ignores the biggest, dumbest issue of all with corporate ethics. Your idea of what is ethical may be very different from mine, and that's okay. Where some people might see environmental destruction, you might see the most affordable fuel source that could heat people's homes and power industries that put food on the table for millions of people. Creating a hard and fast template for what counts as ethical and then rewarding companies that pretend to adhere to it hasn't been good for investors, it hasn't been good for society, but it hasn't even been good for the companies either. Performative ethical measures are often unaffordable to small businesses. If investors and customers are exclusively seeking out businesses that can afford to hire teams to ensure their quality for ethical recognition, then smaller businesses without those resources will be less competitive with larger companies that are normally less ethical in reality anyway. Bill Gurley, a venture capitalist who invests into early startups for a living, has said that regulations overwhelmingly favor incumbent businesses because they are the only ones that can afford to make sure they are compliant, and that applies to self-regulation as well. Gurley is a venture capitalist, so he is financially motivated to make it easier for small businesses to grow. But that doesn't mean he's wrong. Even to large companies that can mask over their ruthless profit motive with ads about how sustainable they are, it's still an expense that doesn't really achieve much, but will ultimately be passed along to their customers. The Nobel laureate economist Milton Friedman argued that this was basically an invisible tax placed on customers and shareholders who may not even personally agree with the brand ethics that companies are self-governing with. Even in cases where corporate social responsibility is not just a marketing exercise, the personal ethics of the corporate executives that are making the framework are likely to be very different than the stakeholders they are working for. A wealthy executive might, for example, prioritize environmental initiatives over increasing worker compensation because to them, that seems like a more important issue. The real solution to all of this is to let regulators regulate. Businesses seek profit, and for the people to decide what businesses should and should not be doing. There are 8.2 million job openings in America right now, and around 7 million people actively looking for a job. There are also millions of Americans who have simply given up on even trying to look for a job. But still, companies are complaining that they can't get the people they need. There is one reason that has been used time and time again to explain all of this.
A range of companies are looking at how to close the skills gap.
Yep, the skills gap. There are people looking for work and jobs on offer, but the skills of those people and the requirements of the jobs just don't line up. It's a simple, elegant explanation to a major problem, but it's also almost entirely made up.
20-year-old Jesus Villegas is in the second year of his training. He's building a career in advanced construction technology.
Today's incomes gap is largely a skills gap.
87% of Americans said that they are going to need to get skills and new training throughout their work life. It's really remarkable.
The skills gap, also known as the skills shortage, or just good old structural unemployment, is a convenient excuse for a lot of major issues in today's job market that are often swept under the rug by businesses, politicians, and even economic statistics. If a hospital is hiring a doctor, but the only person in town looking for a job has a degree in computer science, then obviously that role is not going to be filled regardless of how much time and effort the applicant has put into their education. The argument that you would have seen is that this same problem is playing out everywhere across the world, which is why even if companies claim to be desperate to hire people, you might struggle to find a job. The whole argument conveniently shifts the blame of any labor market problems onto the workers because they are the ones that haven't trained the right skills or developed the right experience. The first problem with this idea, though, is how the problem of the skills gap quietly slips away during the good times. Research published by economists from Harvard, Northern University, and the Federal Reserve found a striking relationship between unemployment and the experience that employers look for in their candidates. The team collected data on over 36 million job postings over 3 years, and what they found was that the skills and experience required was almost directly proportional to the unemployment rate. In plain English, what this meant was that when there were lots of people looking for a job, all of a sudden the skills requirement for roles became a lot higher. And this is when people will start complaining about a skills gap. But when unemployment is lower, and there aren't that many people applying for jobs, suddenly the skills gap isn't such a big problem, and companies are happy to hire whoever they can get. Now, as long as they aren't discriminating based on protected classes, companies can basically hire whoever they want and ask for whatever skills they can. If unemployment is high and they can be greedy with their job requirements, that's just business. But the problem is, the myth of the skills gap is used to justify a lot of bad stuff. The first is simply lower wages. If companies post a position with high skill requirements and they don't get any applicants that meet their unreasonably high bar, they can go back to the best applicant with a lower salary and benefit offer than advertised, pointing out the gaps in their skills as a reason for the lower offer. This is just basic salary negotiation tactics. But the myth of the skills gap makes it easier for companies to get away with this. A report by MIT found that most jobs advertised in America asked for skills like programming that were actually not required to perform the job. They looked specifically at IT help desk technicians that deal with computers. So most companies ask for programming skills. The thing is, though, most IT help desk techs don't actually use programming for anything. But a lot of companies just assume that computers equal code, and so make it a job requirement. The report actually found that programming was just as useful in manufacturing plants as it was in IT help desk work. But factory machine operators were far more likely to get on-the-job training on how to program their machines than IT workers who were just assumed to know how to code. But lower wages are far from the worst thing that the myth of the skills gap has been used to push for. It's also been an incredible tool for lobbying on migration policy, education funding, and workplace protections. These are worth looking at one by one, because you are probably going to start hearing a lot of familiar soundbites. If there was actually a supply of good-paying jobs available to people that were going unfilled because of the skills gap, then the traditional market assumption would be that people would retrain to fill those roles to increase their income and job security. But that isn't happening because there are problems with every part of this assumption. The first problem is that a lot of the jobs we have a skills gap for here in America don't actually pay that well. According to a report by the Society of Resource Management, the hardest roles to fill currently include jobs like nursing, teaching, the trades, and social service work. Most jobs in these roles do not pay enough to support a comfortable life in a major city, especially for entry-level employees into the roles. The trades can be great, but apprentice tradesmen are not going to earn much until they are fully qualified, and even then, they need to work significant overtime or own their own business to make a comfortable salary in most parts of the country. Even still, they are going to be better off than teachers and nurses who not only need a college degree where they won't be paid anything, they also need on-the-job training before they are earning anything at all. That's on top of reports about extreme job stress, brutal work schedules, and the general lack of respect these roles receive. Putting your career on hold, spending tens of thousands of dollars on a college degree, and dealing with difficult patients or often dangerous patients or children is not that enticing to Americans who would consider a career switch because the income for these roles hasn't risen in line with the demand gap. There is not a skills shortage. There is just a shortage of people who want to do difficult jobs for bad pay. People in these roles who already have the skills to perform the job at a high level are leaving because it's just not worth making the sacrifices necessary when there are easier jobs that pay just as much or more. A counterexample to this trend was the rush to train computer science. The tech industry in the 2000s was expanding rapidly, and we didn't have enough coders to perform roles that actually needed programming skills. The allure of high-paying, respected jobs with a good work-life balance meant a lot of very smart people moved into that career path to fill the skills gap because there was a real reward for doing so. Now, there are actually too many qualified programmers, and as the tech industry has cooled down, hundreds of thousands of people have been laid off. Just 5 years ago, though, they would have been told that there isn't enough programmers, and companies are hiring whoever they can as fast as they can. So, the assumption that empty jobs are just waiting to be filled and the only thing standing in the way is the skills gap can be a bit dangerous. But the final piece of the puzzle is how profitable fixing this myth can be. Politicians can win some easy political points by talking about retraining programs, and companies can push the responsibility of staff training onto their workers or those government programs. The market research firm Allied Market Research values the corporate training market at over $361 billion, with it projected to grow to over $800 billion by 2035. That's a major industry just by itself, and it relies heavily on people believing that they are just one qualification away from landing a job that is just desperate to find the right worker. This industry is separate from traditional colleges and trade schools, but you already know what a mess that whole thing is. The skills gap has been a major lobbying tool by companies to push for this kind of training. Siemens, an industrial equipment manufacturer, paid for an article in The Atlantic talking directly to policymakers that the apprenticeships were the secret to closing the skills gap. Apprenticeships are actually great, but the reason that Siemens was paying to publish this article is that it would give them a new pool of skilled workers to pick from, not because they wanted to help out with labor force policies. And this is where you get to the most controversial part of the skills gap. It's used to justify immigration. Now, this is obviously a heated topic that everybody has their own set of opinions on, but it is possible to advocate for more careful and deliberate immigration policies without going full, "they took our jobs." The skills gap has been used to push for a lot of skilled migration, which has arguably gone too far in America, but it's been even more obvious in places like Canada, the UK, Australia, Germany, and New Zealand. The reason companies like this is because it lets them fill roles without putting upward pressure on salaries, and more people means more customers to sell products to. If the skills gap is front and center around these sensitive issues, it makes it easier for policy to be hand-waved through as an essential measure to keep the country functioning. Here in America, H-1B and EB-3 skilled working visas are the most common way to get in workers who fill skilled roles that can't be filled by an American. They come with a strict set of rules to make sure that American workers are not disadvantaged by new foreign hires. But if job requirements are kept unreasonably high to make an artificial skills gap, it becomes easier to hire workers from overseas who will be dependent on that company's sponsorship to stay in America. Who do you think is more likely to be a loyal employee? It's a classic gripe of out-of-touch corporate executives hiring minimum wage workers, or the trust fund baby who is angry that their gym is busy in the middle of the day. Nobody wants to work anymore. Now, I really hate to say this, but by looking at the numbers, they might have a point. Labor force participation is approaching generational lows even after the pandemic, while labor force participation amongst men specifically is the lowest it has ever been. These declines have been happening at the same time that unemployment is theoretically quite low, which, if the economists are to be believed, means it should be easy for people who want to get a job to get a job, right? Well, not quite. And these numbers are confusing at best, or downright misleading at worst.
Is people just don't want to go to work.
There was a poll I read a long time ago. Only like 18% of Americans feel engaged when they're at work.
I hate my job!
The signs are everywhere. Businesses, especially restaurants, need employees and they need them
now.
Dude,
less than 20% of the country likes their f***ing job.
Okay, so there are two general schools that people fall into when they see that nobody wants to work anymore. The first group are wealthy executives, business owners, or just people who have always worked incredibly hard who don't like that jobs are going unfilled. So they blame it on lazy young people who would rather sit around all day smoking cones and watching skibbity toilets. The second school of thought agrees that yes, people don't want to work. They don't want to work demeaning jobs where they won't get paid enough to support a decent quality of life. It's nice when two groups who are so different can agree on something. So really, the only thing left is to work out why people don't want to work. Now, in most cases, the jobs that nobody wants to work fall into one of three categories. The first are jobs that are just paying well below market rates given the experience or the location required. Businesses aren't going to be able to fill a full-stack senior development role in Silicon Valley for $50,000 a year plus equity in their questionable pre-seed startup, but there are still plenty that try. Even entry-level jobs that pay minimum wage in very high cost of living areas are going to be much harder to fill in a city where even finance bros are living in shared housing. Now, hot take alert, but just like there are no shortage of crappy businesses and managers that expect to pay workers nothing for world-class skills and experience, there are lots of workers who expect world-class pay with little or no marketable expertise. One of the most insightful pieces of data on this issue is this recent survey right here. It asked a selection of Americans what they considered to be the minimum salary they would need to be financially successful. Now, most of the responses to these numbers have been laughing at the Gen Zs just entering the workforce who think that almost $600,000 a year is a realistic salary goal. Because for most people, it just isn't. Unless you are in a few very specific career paths, there are basically no jobs that pay this money. And even then, you need an insane amount of luck to get those opportunities. Now, you can blame this on young people who don't really know how the world works yet, or social media that makes it look like every hustle bro is flying private, but it's all distracting from a more interesting data point. The average boomer thinks financial success is achieved with a salary of just under $100,000. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, this is still almost double the median national salary. But in most major cities where people can actually find jobs that pay this much, $100,000 certainly doesn't afford a lifestyle of financial success. There is simply a massive gap in expectations between the generations looking for their first jobs and the group responsible for giving out most of the jobs, so they both agree that nobody wants to work, just for different reasons. The second type of job that nobody wants to work are in workplaces that push their staff, demand unreasonable overtime, or have management that are needlessly abusive. This happens in a shocking amount of businesses across the country. And even if you are lucky enough to avoid a boss that thinks shouting is an effective motivation tool, you have probably worked some overtime out of fear of losing your job or being reprimanded. According to a 2023 workplace survey, the average full-time worker across the country studied is now putting in an average of 9.2 hours of unpaid overtime. These jobs often don't have much trouble finding people to start, but they do struggle with high staff turnover. The third are simply jobs that never actually existed. You probably all know about ghost jobs by now, but even if you really do want to work, there is a good chance that most of your applications are just going to build out a workforce database, not to actually be considered for employment. Now, whatever the specific reason, the results are the same. Less people end up working. But aside from settling some beef between entitled Zoomers and some out-of-touch boomers, this data all reveals something more concerning about work in the current economy. It's not that people don't want to work anymore. They simply can't afford to. Okay, so yeah, there are millions of people out there that think nobody wants to work because they couldn't hire someone with 20 years of experience on a programming language that has only been out for 5 years for $15 an hour. There are also people who don't want to work because they think unless they are offered six figures in their first role out of high school, it's not worth their time, and they would be better off sitting at home working on their NFT dropshipping business. Both of these groups definitely exist in shockingly large numbers, but even though it's really fun to make fun of both sides, it distracts from the much more important reason why labor force participation is getting worse. Well, as you might have been able to guess, this trend is really being driven by specific age groups and specific locations. If you look at labor force participation and exclude the youngest generation of workers and the oldest generation of workers, it's actually approaching all-time highs, which really makes sense when you think about it. It's common for both men and women to work full-time these days, and for most households, it's simply a financial necessity. So yeah, even if people don't want to work anymore, they kind of are stuck doing it anyway. The reason labor force participation has fallen off in general, though, is because the average is being dragged down by a lot of young workers and old workers. The old workers are the easiest to explain. As people started living longer, retirement ages were pushed back, and more of the population began working in non-physical jobs. As a result, a larger share of the population over 55 remained in the workforce. This has started to reverse, though, as self-funded retirement systems and general asset prices have allowed a lot of over 55s to step back from the labor force, especially after COVID, as a lot of people received severance packages and decided that an early retirement was better than going back to the office. Labor force participation from young people just entering the workforce either out of high school or college is also pulling down the average, just for different reasons. More people than ever are getting a college degree, which means they are starting to work later, and fewer people are working part-time jobs while they study because for many, it's simply not worth it given how much debt they are going to be in when they graduate anyway. This might not also be a shock to you, but it's getting really damn hard to find a job out of college. A few months ago, a post from a professor at Berkeley made the rounds after it spoke about his top students from a top college struggling to find work in technology, an industry that was hiring highly intelligent graduates like this as fast as they could make them just 24 months ago. Previously, a Berkeley CS graduate, even if not a top student, would receive multiple appealing job offers in terms of work type, location, salary, and employer. However, outstanding students, like those with a 4.0 in major GPA, are now contacting me worried because they have zero offers. I suspect this trend is irreversible and likely part of the broader trend impacting almost every employment sector. It's pretty grim stuff coming out of one of the best schools in the country. It might not be the most logical thing to do, but a common reaction from people who can't land a job with a degree they got to make them more employable is to just go get another degree. The rate of master's and PhD recipients has grown even faster than people getting an undergraduate degree, because that's now normal to stand out in a highly competitive job market. And to be honest, it's a nice way for people to avoid the reality of the job market for another few years. Spending another 2 to 8 years at college to get advanced degrees means people aren't in the labor force, which pulls down the average to look worse than it really is. So those are the ages that are perpetuating this dumb myth. But this trend is also highly dependent on location. And to see that, you need to go to the place where apparently the absolute least amount of people want to work. Yes, the Rust Belt state has the lowest labor force participation in the country, but also some of the most unusual statistical anomalies. The state is quite poor after its major industries like coal mining and manufacturing were either outsourced or simply fell out of widespread use. This means that a lot of areas have effectively been left behind with no major employment opportunities, meaning that labor force participation is much lower than the national average. But strangely, in some areas, the participation rate is much higher than what would be expected. A recent study conducted by economists from Hamline University, Cornell, and Virginia Tech found that depending on the county, labor force participation in West Virginia ranges from 42% to 77%, a gap between regions of 35%, while the average across the US states is just 17%, less than half of West Virginia. It's not unusual that cities and working towns will have higher labor force participation than other areas, because people often specifically move to these locations just to get work. But this variance was startling and uncovered a bigger national trend. The people in areas that still had work can't afford not to work, and the people in areas with no work couldn't afford to move to areas with work, since it could mean giving up family support networks or simply paying for the cost to relocate housing. A lot of people who had the financial means have already moved out of the state, only making this problem worse, as they take business opportunities and money away with them. It's a dense read because it's an academic paper. It's for nerds. But if you ever feel compelled to say that nobody wants to work anymore, I definitely suggest you have a look at it. The report itself also looks at welfare issues specific to West Virginia. But just because the state is experiencing this problem the worst doesn't mean that it's in any way just something hurting them. The trend of a few concentrated cities doing extremely well while everywhere else stagnates can make nationwide figures look good. But it also means people who want to work have an option of trying their luck for one of the few jobs left in areas with fewer opportunities, or living in an extremely expensive city to compete with everybody else fighting over a spot in the few places left where people can reliably get ahead. Finance and tech have become one of the last escape ropes for people to make a deal with the devil to get out of these areas with little to no opportunities. A study out of Sweden found that the top earners have lower intelligence than the people in income levels directly below them. The plateauing of cognitive ability among top earners drew on data from 59,000 men who had to take a compulsory military conscription aptitude test. It then tracked their earnings over their professional careers to find the relationship between intelligence and income.
Wait. This is interesting.
And before Ty Lopez gets any ideas for more shitty YouTube commercials or the Hustle Bros learn how to read journal articles and use this to encourage people to drop out of college, I want you to know how this data really works. The relationship between intelligence and income was strong. Smarter people earned more money, but only up to 670,000 Swedish krona or $64,000 per year. After that, intelligence didn't mean much anymore, and at the very top end of income earners, the 1%, dumber people, actually did better.
We made all that today?
Well, it was twice as much, but I had to bail out Cinnamon's kid.
Thanks, Mr. Peter! This guy's the best!
So is this a sign that watching TikTok and reality TV is actually better for your career than going to college? Well, maybe actually, for two important reasons. But there are also two reasons why you should probably ignore this and keep studying hard if you want to get ahead financially. Reason number one why dumb people are doing better than smart people is that smart people fill in high-prestige jobs that don't have high salaries. Academics and research scientists are some of the smartest people in the world, but they don't get paid well.
Guys like yourself.
Yeah, how come I can be successful then?
Okay, well, you could be a lot more successful if you had 30 points less IQ.
Doctors, lawyers, and elite financiers also need to be very smart to get through demanding schooling and admissions exams. And these professionals are typically compensated very competitively. But most of them don't make it all the way to the 1%. In the USA, to be in the top 1% of income earners, an individual needs to make at least $597,000 before tax, and that's just the minimum to join the 1% club. The average member of the 1% earns $1.4 million before tax. Some senior executives, certain doctors, lawyers, and even bankers can earn this much money, but they are in the minority. Most people making this much money are business owners, and there is less of an intelligence barrier to becoming a business owner compared to the genius level intellect a person needs to become a top surgeon. Business owners earning over $500,000 a year in income still need to be smart, but they don't need to be as smart as the very few types of workers that an employer would be willing to pay that much.
You do not have to be smart to make money.
People that are highly intelligent and have a desire for high income are also at a slight disadvantage to people that are only moderately intelligent and equally have a desire for high income. Highly intelligent people that follow well-compensated career paths are less likely to make the transition to business ownership because they will reach a level of income that they are satisfied with and won't want to take the risky step of giving up their well-paid job to start a business that might not even succeed. Moderately intelligent people with desire for high incomes, on the other hand, won't have as many opportunities to make incomes in the top percentiles unless they go into business for themselves. So they are on average more willing to take the risk because they won't be giving up a career that was difficult to get into and equally difficult to get back into.
No, I am not going anywhere until you or one of your butlers or bimbos writes me a check.
So by looking at the data, if you want to be wealthy, the best thing you can do is to be moderately intelligent with a lot of ambition, right? Well, as the great Mark Twain said, there are three types of lies: normal lies, damn lies, and statistics. Let's say all you care about is making as much money as possible, and you are trying to pick what person you want to be to give you the highest chance of achieving that goal. The first problem that you will have if you try to plan your career around replicating the success of people in the top 1% is all of the statistical complications that come with inferring outcomes based on data like this. The ceiling effect is what happens towards the extremities of datasets that are drawn on a scale like percentiles of wealth. If a class of 10 students got given a 100-question surprise quiz and 3 students in the class got perfect scores and the 7 other students got a random mix of scores, a statistician could conclude that a perfect score was the easiest result to get because it's the result that happened the most often. No matter how smart the students taking this quiz are, they can't get more than a perfect score. No matter how high someone's income is, the top 1% is the top of the scale. If 2 of the 3 students with perfect scores were the smartest people in the class and the 3rd student was average but just cheated on the quiz by copying the top student in the class, the average intelligence of the students with perfect scores would be lower than the intelligence of the student who got 99 questions right. Most people earning in the top 1% are very smart, but their average is brought down by the people like the Kardashians.
Dude, I am so disillusioned right now.
Most people in the top 2% are also very smart, but they don't have outliers stuck to the ceiling bringing down their average. Less intelligent people earning the most money out of a population also have a problem with survivorship bias. A person of average intelligence starting a business for themselves is statistically very likely to fail and end up in the lower end of the income range. At that point, they can either try and start another business or go back to a regular job. If they are successful though, a business doesn't need to get that large before it can generate enough profit to put the owner in the top 1% of earners. A highly intelligent person starting a business will have slightly better odds of being successful, but statistically, it's still likely to fail. Because there are less highly intelligent people than there are people of average intelligence, there are going to be more successful businesses run by average people than run by intelligent people, and if you remember, highly intelligent people already earning good money in a position as an employee are less likely to start a business of their own in the first place. They're even less likely to end up as a successful or unsuccessful business owner. There will also be many more business failures owned by people of average intelligence, but because only the businesses that survive get counted in the 1% of income earners, it changes the expectation that the best way to get rich is to be a business owner of average intelligence. The second problem with interpreting this study and all of the other studies you hear about is that the traits of wealthy people goes well beyond just statistics. To begin with, this study was conducted on men only. Men have different career earnings and work in different vocations than women, so the results could be very different if the other half of the population was included.
Does that make sense? You see the difference?
Measuring intelligence is very difficult, and a military entrance exam is more likely to be focused on the type of intelligence that would make people good at following orders like comprehension, rather than free thinking and creative intelligence that would provide a competitive advantage in the boardroom but not on the battlefield. The study was also done in Sweden, and I know, thanks to the invasive power of Google's data collection, that only 0.9% of you watching are Swedish.
USA! USA!
Personal finance and careers in Sweden are different from here in the States because they have stronger welfare and worker protections. They also pay lower salaries on average to top employees. Sweden is also surprisingly more entrepreneurial than the States. It has 20 startups per 1,000 people, while America only has 5. So what does this mean? Basically, this means to get into the top 1% where the study was done, you need to be a successful business owner, but in most other places, there is a high chance that you will get there with one of the extremely well-paid jobs that go to extremely intelligent people. It's starting to look bad for the dropout of college hustle bros, and that's before even considering other things that can give people a high income. Some people get a high income not because of luck, intelligence, or hard work. They get it because they are a nepo baby and have family connections which can land them a job that pays well. As unfair as it may be to someone without these advantages, giving rich kids with connections jobs can be worth it if they keep using their connections to bring in more business. Some of these privileged individuals will be smart, some of them not so smart, but they won't need to be as intelligent as a top doctor to earn their money, so they will bring down the average of the percentile they land in. So before that you think that this whole investigation was just a big waste of time, and that it doesn't reveal the secret to becoming a member of the 1%, you should know that it actually does. Let me show you how. There are some factors that can put dumb people in the 1% that you can't control. You don't get to choose if you are born to a wealthy family that can get you a fancy job by calling in a few favors.
Like a little 100 mil.
A little 100 mil.
You can also only do so much to control whether your business is highly successful, just breaking even, or a complete failure. A lot of it is just luck.
You know what? Who gives a shit?
But here is something else. You can't 100% control how intelligent you are either. You can practice certain skills, learn new things, but some people will be able to absorb and apply knowledge better than others. You can't copy traits and expect a similar outcome. You have to be able to critically assess your strengths and weaknesses and choose a career path that suits you best. Rich people eat a lot of caviar and fly first class, but flying first class and eating caviar won't make you rich, just like being of average intelligence won't make you a member of the 1% by itself. The first real step is to work out what you are good at and what you are bad at. This may involve admitting to yourself that you are not as smart as you think you are. It might hurt your ego, but being honest with yourself about your weaknesses will bring you much further than believing you're good at things that you're not. Highly competitive industries reward high performers, but they are also equally punishing underperformers. Becoming a doctor will almost guarantee an upper middle class or upper class income for the rest of your working life, but failing out of med school will leave you with hundreds of thousands of dollars of student loans that will put you far behind people who are more realistic with their career ambitions. An electrician that does the best work in their area and has a good reputation with builders and businesses will make more money than a lawyer that is average or below average. That doesn't mean drop out of college. It means be honest with yourself about what marketable field you could excel in and do that instead of trying to chase career paths that just have a reputation for earning a lot of money, because if you do, you might end up like the people that rushed into tech jobs to chase big paychecks just before the biggest companies in the space announced record layoffs. You know you are a lazy person, and there are thousands of people who want to tell you exactly how to fix that. But the truth is, you are probably just fine, and falling too far into the productivity rabbit hole will just make you lazier, more stressed, and poorer than when you started.
Productivity.
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 Modern life is full of an endless list of things to do. You spend a lot of time getting to a job, putting in your 8 hours a day, if you are lucky, getting home again, and only then can you go shopping, clean your house, wash your clothes, pay your bills, cook, and help out your family with anything they need. Thanks to the rising cost of living and stagnating wages, you might also want to include a side hustle or a business project in addition to everything else. Oh, and at some point, have some time to relax with friends and family or just get a good night's sleep. It's a lot. And us humans were not meant to be this switched on all the time. So to keep you on your grind and to help you feel a little bit less overwhelmed by everything that you need to do, there is a new movement of pseudo self-help gurus. These people promise to teach you simple tricks that conveniently fit into seminars, books, or 15-minute YouTube videos that will help you to better organize your life, stay motivated, and achieve your goals, even if your goal is not having to work two jobs. It sounds helpful, or at the very least, harmless. But following this advice could put you further behind for four reasons. The first reason is that it just doesn't work. Productivity brands and influencers have the opposite problem to finfluencers, another group that promises to fix your finances instead of everything else in your life. Good personal finance should be boring and simple. Save diligently, avoid high interest debt, maximize your income, and invest responsibly for long-term goals. It's so simple that everything you need to know about personal finance can fit on a post-it note, and people have done it. That's a problem for personal finance influencers, because they make a lot of money by posting weekly content and can't keep saying the same thing every week, so they end up making uninformed predictions or telling financial success stories that were more a product of luck than diligent financial planning. But we have already talked enough about these guys before. Productivity influencers have the opposite problem. There is just too much to talk about, and without knowing each and every one of their viewer situations, they can't come up with good suggestions. And uninformed advice is the same thing as bad advice. A report by Psychology Today found that so-called toxic productivity is one of the leading causes of diagnosed anxiety and depression. A strong focus on productivity also produces worse outcomes for everyone. A report by the Harvard Business Review studied employees who were fired for bad workplace behavior. The study found that a large share of those terminated employees were high performers in their roles, but brought down everybody that worked with them. The researchers found that a worker that had an intense focus on their own productivity might return $5,303 in cost savings to a company through increased output. Avoiding a toxic hire will net an estimated $12,489 because they collaborate more easily with coworkers and clients are less resistant to changes in the organization. An extreme focus on productivity in your personal life can also simply make you less productive, as you spend all your time and effort hyper-optimizing every task in your life instead of just getting them done in a way that works for you. Despite the crazy amount of harm this can do, there are three terrible reasons why the cult of productivity isn't going anywhere. The number of hours Americans work has gone down over the decades according to the OECD. But at the same time, people report having less time to themselves, and there are three reasons for this. Technology has made our work easier, but it has also made it easier to be at work. A 2017 Gallup survey of 15,000 American workers found that 43% of people spent at least some of their personal time working remotely. No follow-up studies have been done, but that figure is likely to rise with the mass adoption of work from home from 2020 until lately. Employers are also demanding more unpaid overtime for non-hourly workers, and these requests are often coming at odd times, reducing the amount of quality uninterrupted free time where workers are allowed to totally disconnect from their job. The psychologist Adam Alter said that if you carry around a phone that your boss or team can message or call you on at any time, you probably haven't had real free time to yourself for years. The second reason is that people who work are working less, but more people are working. A stay-at-home partner who takes care of chores, children, and other tasks is now a luxury that most people can't afford. A growing number of people are also remaining single for longer, so people have to do their jobs and their chores when they get home without the help they would have gotten in the past from more traditional family units. The third reason is simply that there are more distractions. When was the last time you felt bored? Probably a long time ago, right? Because today, right there in your pocket, is a phone that gives you access to games, messages, and apps that are literally designed from the ground up to give you dopamine on demand and are hyper-optimized to keep your attention. Companies and people pushing that hashtag hustle mindset have undoubtedly created these problems, and they are also cashing in on the opportunity to sell you the solution. And that's the third reason why the cult of toxic productivity has grown so large. It's too profitable. According to Precision Reports, a market research firm, the global market for productivity apps was worth $9.42 billion in 2022 and is expected to grow by 9.2% per year until 2028. In addition to this market, there are also people selling books, courses, consultations, and tutorials on avoiding the world's distractions and squeezing the most out of your day. It's a big market for one simple reason. People who have decided that they want to be more productive are high-intent customers, and they are willing to spend a lot of money on a good solution because they think of it as an investment rather than a purchase. If someone could give you an app or a course that would let you focus for longer and build out a side business that doubled your monthly income, of course you would pay a lot for that. People seeking out ways to maximize their productivity are also on average wealthier, as people who are into self-improvement and are short on time often are. This means that people can make millions of dollars very quickly if they can amass an audience and convince them that they have the secret to maximizing productivity. I am going to stop short of calling these a get-rich-quick scheme-style grift, because I do believe that the most popular personalities in the space, like Ali Abdaal, Alex Hormozi, and even Gary Vee, really do have good intentions with their audience, and they don't intend any harm. Some other self-improvement personalities don't care as much and just want to get you to buy their course by any means necessary. But even these good guys still have something to sell you. It's a classic strategy of, hey, look at me, I am rich and successful, and you could be too, if you do this thing that I am selling. a video about how someone made $10 million a year and a breakdown of their revenue sources might generally be made with the best of intentions of transparency, but it also serves as a demonstration of how well their advice has worked for them and how it could work for you too. In the interest of my own transparency, I have made the same kind of video because I thought it was interesting and I thought it would get views, but I don't have a course on how to run multiple businesses or get big on YouTube. Some of these tools these people and companies are selling are totally free, but some can cost thousands of dollars. And with an audience that is so intent on changing their life for the better, it's not unusual for people to take on credit card debt to attend a mindset conference or buy a course that they think will change their life. Now, if you pick up some tricks that help you stay on top of your meetings or just feel less stressed about your everyday chores, that's great. And if that's worth investing some money, go ahead. But there aren't millions of people watching this with the goal of minor improvements. People are expecting something much bigger that simply can't be bought. Working out how to stay focused for every hour of the day is probably not going to radically change your life. In my career as an investment banker, I got to work directly with hundreds of very successful company founders that were raising hundreds of millions of dollars for their businesses. All of them were very busy people, but none of them tried to optimize every hour of the working day or work 100-hour weeks to make their business a success. It's also not fair to even compare regular people to highly successful business people either, because they often have assistants and other staff to take care of them, so even if they are spending long hours in the office, they have everything else in their life taken care of. And that's the third reason why falling into the productivity rabbit hole can leave you much worse off in the long run, which is that you are probably wasting your time. This works in two ways, so let's call them reason 3A and reason 3B. The first way this will end up wasting your time is that after setting up calendars, reminders, journals, meditation sessions, attending seminars, and watching productivity content, you have probably wasted more time than you will ever save with a simple plan that you work out as you go along. Reason 3B is a little bit more interesting though. Being productive is not the same as being busy. But if you're focused on not wasting any of your time, you are more likely to divert your attention to things that aren't going to do you any good. A survey conducted by 1,989 office workers in the United Kingdom found that the average person was on task for just 2 hours and 53 minutes a day. Trying to optimize that time to get more done in a day is only going to result in you being given more work to do, which is great for the company you work for, but doesn't help you much. Strong performance is important for career progression, but being the guy that does the work of 3 normal coworkers isn't the right way to show you're the right person for a promotion. Being too good at your job is also one of the leading reasons that managers have given for not promoting staff because they will be too hard to replace. Even if you are a business owner and you do financially benefit directly from every additional bit of work you get done, the mindset that a lot of productivity gurus preach is not going to make your business sustainable or scalable. The cult of productivity is weirdly split on this. Some people advocate working 100 weeks until you are a billionaire and only then are you worthy of a day off. And some argue that if you are getting paid based on how many hours you work, you are a loser that can't properly delegate. There is no single right way to run a business, and owners usually do work more hours than their employees. But nobody can produce good quality work 100 hours every week, and not every business owner can or wants to delegate their jobs to a team, taking us back to the problem of specific advice for a broad audience. If it wasn't clear by now, it's okay to not be productive. Comparing yourself to people online who are outstandingly lucky or simply make it their career to talk about how organized they are is not going to do anything good for you. Over the last 2 years, the value of everything from G-Class Mercedes to Rolex Submariners, luxury handbags, and trading cards has taken a huge hit. Basically, if you saw a luxury product in a sketchy ad from some guy trying to sell you a dropshipping course, it's probably halved in value. If you are ever feeling bad about your own personal financial choices, go and watch finance brokers try to unwind someone who has $150,000 in negative equity on an electric Hummer that they purchased with an 8-year loan to rent out on Turo. It should make you feel much better. But I am sorry to tell you that these things might be starting to turn around for these douchebags. We are re-entering a market where Bitcoin is breaking all-time records, stonks are only going up, and Dogecoin is worth more than Nintendo, Delta Airlines, or the Ford Motor Company. In a market where prices only go up, you better brace yourself, because people are going to say that just about anything is an investment to convince their customers, to convince their partners, or just to convince themselves. But that doesn't matter, as long as they can't convince you.
That is how I could justify spending $11,000 on a first edition pack of Pokemon cards from Logan Paul.
That watches are actually not just fashion, not just a statement about who you are.
I have been collecting these bags for a minute. They're also a great investment.
I'm sorry. You owe about $190 left?
Yeah.
All right, Hummer EV. Did you see my other Hummer video with the guy that was like $100,000 upside down?
Yeah.
Alternative investments do have a lot of attractive qualities for sophisticated investors that know how to effectively use them. Assets like commercial real estate, patents, private equity, distressed debt, commodities, and even some collectibles have been purchased by wealthy people as part of their broader investment strategy because they do actually have a few advantages. The value of these assets are often uncorrelated to the return of the stock market, which means that if you are a wealthy individual that loses their job during a market crash, you won't have to sell your investment at record low prices to stay afloat because some of your alternative investments should still be doing fine. If you just had investment in equities and lost your high-paying job in a market crash, you might be forced to sell your shares at the bottom of the market, which, as the finance bros say, is not awesome. Some alternative investments also let their investors have more control over their value. If you own a boring, old, well-diversified stock portfolio, there isn't much you can do to make the whole stock market more valuable. If you own a piece of commercial real estate or even something like artwork, you can market it, or do it up, which might help improve its sale price. Alternative investments also generally have less competitive markets. If you are trying to find an edge in the market for stocks or bonds, you are going up against teams of quantitative analysts from Jane Street and Citadel Securities who did a four-year math program at MIT just to eke out 5 basis points of alpha. You might actually know something about a niche alternative investment that does genuinely give you an edge without it bordering on insider trading because the Securities and Exchange Commission really doesn't care about what happens in these markets. Now, if you are an industry insider, that could be a really good thing. But more likely for you, it's a really bad thing. So before you go and rethink that Masterworks investment, you should also know about the long list of drawbacks with alternative investments. They are normally highly illiquid because the market for them is niche, which means finding a competitive buyer can sometimes take years. They are also much more expensive to buy and sell. You can buy stocks on any number of commission-free brokerages, and while they do have some hidden fees, they are barely a rounding error. If you want to sell a piece of artwork, piece of jewelry, or some other collectible, you are probably going to need to go through an auction house or third-party dealer. Sotheby's, for example, is the most well-known auction house in the world, and they charge a 20% commission on any sale under $10 million, which is actually paid by the buyer. Any investment where you are automatically 20% down the moment you make your purchase is going to be risky, at best. But let's be honest, most of you watching aren't seriously considering a multi-million dollar artwork to round out your investment strategy. And if you are seriously considering a syndicated artwork investment system, then I have really failed to teach you how money works. The alternative investments that have really been generating all the attention are manufactured luxury goods that can't keep up with demand, or intentionally limit production to create a sense of exclusivity. High-end luxury watches from brands like Patek Philippe and Rolex, limited-run cars, as well as certain designer shoes and handbags all have long waitlists from authorized dealers that can stretch for years before you're even allowed to drop 5 figures on a fashion accessory. This has created a huge gray market for these items where people can wait to buy a bag or a watch from these stores and then sell them for a premium to a buyer who just wants their new toy right now. Something that you can buy one day and then instantly sell the next day for a huge premium sounds like the most risk-free investment there is, and it would be if it actually worked like that. People have seen the opportunity to make some easy money and have ran with it so hard that there are even sites that collate sales data to make trackable indexes, which, as you can see, have not been telling a good story about the actual performance of these investments. It might be unsurprising to you, but the hype around these markets is also highly correlated with the hype around other alternative investments like cryptocurrencies. And with the current massive rally in dog-themed financial instruments and other such nonsense, we gotta talk about it before anybody else does something stupid. There is, of course, another reason why people are attracted to highly speculative alternative investments, and that's simply their potential to be a lottery ticket out of poverty. A well-diversified portfolio of stocks, bonds, and real estate is an incredibly powerful tool to build wealth. But if you don't have any wealth to begin with, even Warren Buffett-level returns won't make you wealthy within your lifetime unless you can make consistent contributions towards those investments. Cryptocurrencies, meme stocks, trading cards, and even straight-up gambling is giving hope to a lot of people, even if for most of them it will only make their problems worse. But for the lucky few who did time their purchases correctly, they have turned incidental amounts of money into very substantial positions. The people that have sold out of these positions have a higher propensity to consume, especially on luxury goods to show off their new fortunes, which was in part why the aftermarket for luxury goods saw such a boom from 2020 to 2022. The trend was so strong that these items were seen as investments themselves, The brands themselves, although they would never publicly admit it, heavily played into this idea of scarcity by limiting their production of popular products and raising prices above the rate of inflation year after year to make it seem like it was a privilege to pay the price of a family SUV for a watch. At the end of the day, these are companies with a profit motive, and the only reason they would limit production is because it would increase the premium they could charge. Paying $50,000 for a watch seems stupid. But if someone that just made a fortune on a monkey JPEG is willing to buy it off you for $100,000, then it's just responsible investing. But what is particularly interesting is why this isn't happening again this time. The price of highly risky investments is up, but the price of all the junk that people normally buy when their doggy coin moons has stayed down. So, what gives? The logical answer is that sports betting and meme coin speculators have suddenly become very fiscally responsible. And instead of blowing their profits on babbling goods to show off their newfound wealth, they are prudently investing it into a structured portfolio to provide them with a stable return. Yeah, okay. So there are actually three things that have happened here. These dumb expensive trinkets that people insisted were great investments are actually an indication of a much bigger shift in the economy and habits of retail investors. The first big change is that these markets, which used to be made up of small-time, unsophisticated investors, have become just as consolidated, if not more consolidated than traditional equities markets, with the largest, wealthiest investors controlling a huge share of the total supply of things like cryptocurrencies. Bitcoin going from 20k to 90k in a year will make people a lot of money, but it's going mainly to the type of people that already had a lot of money to put into a risky investment. It's a huge return, but to someone who only had $1,000 to invest, it's not going to make them life-changing amounts of money like it would have if they invested early in the 2010s. If the Winklevoss twins make an extra $1 billion on the appreciation of Bitcoin, they are not going to wear 100,000 Patek Philippe's, which means even though the net wealth creation might be the same, the resulting propensity to consume is much lower when the rewards are going to people who could have already purchased any luxury good they ever wanted. For many of the small investors who want a chance to make life-changing amounts of money from their limited capital, the boat has already sailed on Bitcoin, which is why people keep falling for rug pull after rug pull on the promise that this time will be different, because they simply need the chance. The reason that people are making these gambles is also different. A Wall Street Journal survey of investors with low FICO scores found that their primary reason for investing was not to build wealth, but to pay off debt. Credit card debt is now approaching all-time highs, and interest rates on all kinds of borrowing is up. So even when people are lucky enough to turn a profit on these extremely risky investments, they are just going back to square one, not actually getting ahead. 4 years ago, dumb investments were turning people's stimulus checks into enough money for a down payment on a Lamborghini Urus. Today, they are lucky if it pays off their heavily underwater car loan. People are no longer being greedy. They are just being desperate. Now, you have probably experienced this cultural shift from the pandemic-era exuberance to the more cautious financial environment today, even though most macroeconomic indicators are up and to the right. But these investments are also getting hurt by a market where none of you are watching from, which hasn't even been able to make its broad economic indicators look good. China has become the largest market in the world for luxury goods because the country has produced a lot of wealthy people very quickly, and those people are eager to show off their newfound fortunes with luxury goods. Unfortunately, real estate, the primary wealth generator in China and the single largest asset market in the entire world, has been floundering since Evergrande and other major property developers started failing and flooding the market with more apartments at fire sale prices. This wealth destruction, along with a strong push by the government to crack down on extravagant displays of wealth, has meant demand for luxury goods in the country has fallen, at the same time as luxury good companies have expended to keep up with demand that has disappeared. It should go without saying, but even really smart people can do stupid things with their money if they want something to be true. A lot of people want to convince themselves that their new luxury purchase is not only a nice toy, but a prudent investment, when it simply isn't. Even if there is a premium between retail price and what it could be sold for in the gray market, you normally have to spend a lot of money at authorized dealers before you're allowed to get to the front of the waitlist. After that, the risk-adjusted returns are probably very bad, if not non-existent. If you want to invest your money, invest your money. If you want to buy something nice to treat yourself by buying something nice, treat yourself. Don't compromise and do both poorly. Now, the bonus fourth reason is the cultural shift away from conspicuous displays of wealth. I'm going to be writing an article on my completely free email newsletter about why role-playing as a poor person has suddenly become the new trend amongst wealthy people, especially in big cities. And if all this has convinced you to stick with traditional investments, then go and watch my other video on why you are not actually an investor at all to keep on learning how money works.